English from a menu of languages, then pointed at my location on a city map and received instant information and emergency instructions if necessary. Instead of being at the mercy of filtered and delayed broadcast information, I would have had the immediate experience and comfort of information access, helping myself to precisely what I wanted to know virtually in real time. We commonly think of media as the media, meaning video and print communication channels, television, newspapers, or magazines, rather than as what they actually are, the plural form of medium, or a means of conveyance. Traditional broadcast media can be seen as one-way pipes. The new forms of interactive digital media are bidirectional. They come in a variety of forms and can be embedded inside almost anything, from kiosks to kitchen appliances. After this evolutionary shift, mass broadcast media, as we know them today, will be virtually unrecognizable. Digital media increasingly bring the user under the spell of conveyance and facility. They transform behavior by giving people unprecedented access to all kinds of places, people, and ideas, unconstrained by time, culture, or geography. Consumers are being taught by these media to unlearn their conditioning by repetitious broadcast messages. As Nicholas Negroponte, founder of the Media Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, puts it in his book, Being Digital, being digital will change the nature of mass media from a process of pushing bits at people to one of allowing people, or their computers, to pull at them. Just as fast and easy to use ATMs have become a part of daily life, many other transactions will turn transparent, that is, become streamlined and unobtrusive. We'll make airline, car rental, and hotel reservations ourselves, without human intermediaries, have medical lab work done at the local pharmacy, buy and sell stocks anytime, any place, hold three-way parent-teacher-student conferences online, and broadcast amateur comedy shows from our living rooms. New media will transform business. Access media are spurring a reimagining and redesign of almost every familiar and ordinary human activity. Interactivity is coming into play everywhere in business, wherever organizations perceive opportunities to better serve their customers by giving them access to means of serving themselves. The tools already exist for businesses to create their own channels, networks, and programming for dialogue with or narrowcasting to employees and customers. In February 1994, Hyatt Hotels and Resorts began to offer guests at some of its branches the use of an electronic check-in and check-out kiosk located in the lobby. Checking in, guests with reservations run their credit cards through a slot in the kiosk, then touch a screen to choose between rooms for smokers and non-smokers, with or without views, and so on. Next, the kiosk returns a key card and a folder imprinted with a selected room number. At checkout time, the kiosk spits out an itemized list of charges. That same check-in, check-out hotel kiosk could be a communications channel for making rental car or airplane reservations, checking on the weather in another city, obtaining stock market quotes, sending an email message, or watching a 2-minute entertainment video clip. But that's not all. Just as we have seen TV viewing channels multiply, so will corporate channels and networks. Company communication channels will be developed so that corporations can interact not just with customers, but also with the broad spectrum of their stakeholders. Business-to-business networks may become an ever-present educational resource, showing organizations how to refine their offerings for greater appeal to buyers. As judged by the standards of the past, all the new and incipient forms of dialogue represent a radical shift in approach, a change the enormity of which I remind myself with an incident that dates to the mid-1960s, when I bought a defective RCA television set. Tired of the local RCA dealer's inadequate explanations for the cause of the trouble and weeks of procrastination for repairs, I called the head of the company's consumer products division and talked my way past his telephone sentries to get him on the line. I introduced myself and gave him a concise account of my difficulties. In response, he had only one question for me, asked in a tone of icy outrage: "How did you get through?" His reply now seems to me the perfect emblem of companies' attitudes toward customers in the industrial age of marketing. Not only is direct access for customers the essence of marketing today, but the organizations most deeply committed to the new model aim to be, in some sense, with their customers all the time. 24-hour bits-based dialogue. PepsiCo supplies an excellent illustration of the shades of interactivity to come. In the summer of 1996, the company offered the young consumers of its Mountain Dew soft drink electronic beepers, ordinarily priced at around $60 for $29.99 plus shipping and handling, plus 6 months of free airtime worth $135. For the 6 months of the promotion, Mountain Dew paged the 50,000 teenage and Generation X participants once a week and gave them a toll-free number to call. Over the telephone connection, these young people could listen to interviews with heroes of so-called extreme sports, such as bungee jumping and sky surfing, that feature in Mountain Dew's TV commercials. They could also learn about opportunities to win discounts and prizes from 20 companies whose buyers overlap heavily with Mountain Dew's so-called Dew Dudes. These included Burton Snowboards, Killer Loop Sunglasses, Sony Music, Doritos, Universal Studios, Spin Magazine, Wavesport, and K2 Inline Skates. All the brand names on the list had been chosen by Mountain Dew customers in marketing focus groups as companies they would like to hear from. The idea, as a Mountain Dew marketing director explains, was to offer customers a product to fit their lifestyle and make them part of a really cool network. Not only did the beepers give Mountain Dew access to a segment of the consumer marketplace exceedingly difficult to reach through conventional media, print, radio, and TV advertising, as well as telemarketing, but the PepsiCo marketing managers envisaged using the beepers in the future to ask customers their opinions of the product and its advertising and of possible promotions and product ideas. They foresaw interactive communications initiated with beepers, combined with responses and suggestions made at the PepsiCo website on the internet, creating an enormous, non-stop electronic focus group at a remarkably low cost. Although this approach to marketing is unproven, it is a foreshadowing of future strategies. Old sources of revenue will be choked off. Pepsi's sort of dialogue, fostered by the new interactive technologies, will sound the death knell for traditional informational advertising. The want ads, radio and TV program schedules, stock and real estate listings, on which newspapers depend for both revenues and readers. Much of the infrastructure for an interactive classified network is already in place. Across the net, thousands of companies now list job openings on their homepage and servers. The network instantly matches job seekers' qualifications to those openings, supplying a list of possible employment opportunities. Anyone who wants to know more about a particular company can, at the click of a mouse button, browse through financials, product descriptions, benefits, video clips of employees discussing the work environment, and a message from the president. All that is left for the job seeker to do is submit an electronic application. In the future, a unique address number might be assigned to each job seeker, to which she might have former employers and associates' email references. Job applicants might be able to call up their files to check on the status of their applications at any time. Many newspaper publishers today mistakenly believe that the new media are simply about moving classified advertising online. In fact, they represent a discontinuous leap in the structure of commerce. Conventional real estate listings face the same fate as traditional job advertisements. Since 1996, the nationwide real estate franchise chain HFS Incorporated, which owns Century 21 Real Estate, among other agencies, has been developing a web-based listing service for property buyers. Instead of combing through pages of classified ads, a form of broadcast information, to find houses in their price range with the features they want, house hunters would type into their computers the names of cities and neighborhoods that interest them, along with their target price range, to get background information. This would include facts about schools and other community facilities, trends in real estate values, as well as photographs and detailed descriptions of houses that fit their budget. In this way, people could search for a house by day or night from anywhere they have access to a computer with an internet connection. Incidentally, HFS's plan would also help the company attain its goal of cutting down the average number of houses real estate agents show clients from 12 to 8. Television commercials will hardly be immune from these forces of change. Ed Arzt, chairman and CEO of Procter & Gamble, shocked the advertising community when he addressed the American Association of Advertising Agencies in May 1994. Arzt said, From where we stand today, we can't be sure that ad-supported TV programming will have a future in the world being created, a world of video on demand, pay-per-view, and subscription television. Within the next few years, surely before the end of the decade, consumers will be choosing among hundreds of shows and pay-per-view movies. They'll have dozens of home shopping channels. They'll play hours of interactive video games. And for many of these, maybe most, no advertising at all. If that happens, if advertising is no longer needed to pay most of the cost of home entertainment, then advertisers like us will have a hard time achieving the reach and frequency we need to support our brands. Mass media reflect the technology-induced fragmentation of mass markets. The very essence of the new technological capabilities is to permit business to cater to far narrower segments of society than was ever economically possible with the old tools of mass production. When everything we encounter is in some form interactive information, communication, or entertainment, the role of fixed and static forms of media in our lives will steadily diminish. Which is not to say that newspapers and other traditional media will vanish anytime soon. I believe they will for some years continue to repeat their recent history of upheavals in operations, content, marketing, and ownership. Not one of the big three networks, ABC, NBC, or CBS, remains independent. Though they have retained their names, their ownership and business models have significantly changed, thanks to the growth of cable television and narrowcasting. Everything is entertainment. The new paradigm that PepsiCo's Mountain Dew promotion illustrates, marketing as real-time dialogue, also demonstrates the other key facet of the all-pervasive new media, its entertainment value. Human interfaces for sophisticated and, to most people, incomprehensible new technologies beguile and seduce by employing tools drawn from the movies, TV sitcoms, and popular music. It has already become a cliché to say that from education to healthcare, politics to business, everything is in some sense a form of entertainment. In a 1996 Nielsen Media Research survey of households with internet access, 51% of respondents gave entertainment as their reason for using the net. This was followed by those who used it to look up news and current events, 49%, to investigate computer products, 41%, to get travel information, 30%, and to get financial information, 26%. In three very different ways, entertainment, more than anything else, is driving the dissemination of the technologies behind the new media, even as it lends them the power to stir and play on human feelings and emotions. First, the new media, because of their novelty and strangeness, are intrinsically entertaining to the more adventurous segments of the population, known as early adopters. Second, though the excitement of exchanging email and searching the web for their own sake wears off, the expanding bandwidth will offer new forms of information, combining voice, video, graphics, email, and video feedback. Finally, entertainment is engagement. It attracts and holds attention. British commentator Anthony Smith, observing the 20th century's search for escapist devices, notes that entertainment is crucial to the forms that these devices will take and the uses to which they will be put. Entertainment reflects something of the psychic drives that lie deeper than the immediately apparent demands of the market. Ingenuity in the provision of new forms of entertainment is likely to provide much of the drive for big technological leaps. Only about 30% of American homes today have personal computers, while more than 90% have TV sets. The creation of a communications infrastructure merging telephone, interactive cable television, and personal computing linked to the internet is being driven above all by the certainty of a huge market for movies on demand, home shopping, and other forms of entertainment. Outlining his plan for maintaining Citibank's lead in upscale consumer banking in Asia, the company's branch banking chief, William Campbell, mentioned adding new languages to the 13 now handled by Citibank's automatic tellers. He also wants to extend stock trading and bill-paying capabilities to ATMs. But overall, Campbell's strategy rests on making Citibank viscerally compelling. "I don't think many people feel about their bank the way they feel about Disneyland," he told the New York Times. To this end, in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, for instance, Citibank ingeniously pampers customers with more than $120,000 in their accounts, giving them access to an exclusive Citigold program. They are served tea in a fantasy setting, like something from a club in the days of the British Raj. The bank branch has a chandelier, a fountain, and luxurious lounge furniture. Banks once sought images of dignity, reserve, and gray-suited remoteness. Today, they seek the peerless skills of the Disney empire to lift people out of dreary daily preoccupations. Perhaps we will all someday live inside entertainment, artifacts of fantasy and distraction. A New Yorker profile of a planned community, expected by its writer, social critic Witold Rybczynski, to be a model for the future, featured Celebration, a futuristic town built by the Walt Disney Company. Celebration is in Florida, on the same 28,000-acre tract of land as the theme park Epcot. It finally brings to life Walt Disney's original vision for the place, buried in the acronym which stands for Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow. Because Disney conceived of a world in which science and technology would solve nearly all problems, the town has a high-tech infrastructure hidden behind the melange of nostalgic architectural styles, coastal, classical, Victorian, colonial revival, Mediterranean, and French, in which its houses are being built. Part of Celebration was opened in 1996. Future additions to the town include fiber-optic links between individual homes and the school, and between homes and the health campus. Rybczynski observes, "The notion that Disney World could be a setting for real life will strike most people as improbable." Actually, in what cyberpunk fiction writer William Gibson calls our hyper-mediated world, the idea seems less preposterous every day. There are all sorts of intriguing testimonials to entertainment's expanding role in framing our existence. After much anxious debate on the matter, some old order Amish communities that had forbidden their members to drive cars and ride motorcycles or even bicycles began to permit the use of inline skates in the mid-1990s. The preservation of the Amish's austere and traditional way of life is the raison d'etre of Amish settlements, and some community elders viewed inline skates as a serious potential threat to that way of life. Why? Because attached to the skates are three defining features of modernity: speed, convenience, and entertainment. Society loves media. Society hates media. Businesses seeking to take advantage of the new media's speed, transparency, interactivity, and ability to engage customers so profoundly will forget at their peril that its power is a double-edged sword. As much as media are perceived to be uncannily pervasive and affecting, they are also perceived as insidious. Many people feel overwhelmed by broadcast media. Many are far more anxious over than delighted by the idea of 500 different television channels. We all have an inborn sense of unease with rapid change, and our uneasiness about the effects of proliferating media, millions of blurred events bombarding our minds each day, changing attitudes, opinions, and behavior, is bound up with our having been cast adrift from our once secure sense of time and place. Many fear that information and media, cloaked in entertainment, could be used, or are being used, to control and manipulate people and society. In Buried Alive, film critic David Denby's anguished essay about trying to protect his children from the media onslaught, the author finds himself supporting the advent of the V-chip, the microprocessor to be included in all new TV sets from 1998 on, allowing parents to block out programming they wish to screen from their children, in spite of his passionate advocacy of freedom of expression. This freedom, he reluctantly admits, licenses as much schlock as it does high art. Like himself, he says, many parents are upset by the way pop culture in all its forms has invaded their homes and the habits, manners, and souls of their children. We all believe in choice, but our children, to our chagrin, may no longer have the choice not to live in pop. They are shaped by the media as consumers before they've had a chance to develop their souls. Tread carefully. Volatile reactions ahead. Managers must constantly be aware of how fine a line separates the impression that companies are using the new media to better understand and serve customers from the perception that they are trying to exploit customers. PepsiCo, for example, ran into a firestorm of unanticipated criticism with its futuristic promotion involving pagers. The company had assumed that this, of all communications technologies, would be irresistible to parents, helping two career couples worried about their children's whereabouts to keep in touch with them. Instead, the promotion was denounced as disturbingly manipulative by parents and children's advocates, like the Center for Media Advocacy in Washington, D.C., a watchdog group, and Action for Children's Television. Concerns about the media's exploitative potential are equaled or exceeded by other fears of social fragmentation and social polarization, of information and disinformation overload, of people disengaged from communal life and ensconced in dream worlds conjured by the technologies of virtual reality. Many people are deeply disturbed by the unresolved questions the new media are raising, some examples of which follow. Is virtual reality a plus or minus for society, given that it can isolate people in artificial cloisters? To be sure, virtual reality is not the same as being there, just as online communication lacks the complexity and subtle cues of real-life encounters. For important human interactions, nothing is as good as face-to-face contact, or all we can observe or intuit from gestures, body language, tone of voice, facial expression, and a handshake to decide issues of trust and confidence. On the other hand, the new communications tools allow profoundly human exchanges that would not have been possible before. For example, children seriously or terminally ill in hospitals across the country are being helped to overcome fear and feelings of acute anxiety with the aid of interactive technology and entertainment. Everything from simulation to video conferencing is being used to create virtual playgrounds. I watched one small boy at the Stanford Lucille Salter Packard Children's Hospital get a much-needed break from his ordeal, completely absorbed in a computer game. Using his avatar to execute a move that involved opening a virtual door on his computer screen at the same instant that his friend, a boy his age in a hospital in Pittsburgh, made a matching move, he was lost in the pleasures of the virtual world, enjoyment heightened by long-distance collaboration. That link was created by Starbright Pediatric Network, an affiliation of top medical professionals, technologists, and entertainment specialists that is researching in its digital distraction lab the role that virtual reality software can play in helping seriously ill children better cope with their plight. I use this example to illustrate an optimistic viewpoint of this new media as collaborative, engaging, and certainly a new way of expressing oneself. Stefan Pachikov, founder of the virtual reality software company Paragraph International, uses the term alter ego to describe the personality assumed by the avatar. The avatar's sponsor, the real person, is able to imbue his representative character, the avatar or virtual person, with as much or as little of himself as desired. Through dialogue, shared exploration, and discovery with participating virtual people, the avatar grows in knowledge of self and other. In this way, the collaborating avatars share experiences and get to know one another. We may well be witnessing and participating in the evolution of an entirely new form of human communication. How can anyone create a coherent worldview from the atomization of life experience conveyed by media, new and old? How are we to distinguish the real from the unreal, truth from lies, when digital information is so easily manipulated, when we are all but deafened by the cacophony of voices competing for our attention, and when both facts and interpretations of facts are so prolific? Many an inner-city student, for instance, is faced with the challenge of reconciling the following dissonant perspectives and milieus: television's made-up worlds of both violence and privilege, the orderly universe evoked by computers, a safe community of online correspondents, the outer reality of a neighborhood racked by crime, drugs, and violence. For some of these young people, the challenge may not be surmountable. Their actions and the course of their lives will reflect the chaos of their worldview. On the other hand, the new media will also lay at these students' feet unprecedented opportunities for education, which will hone their critical faculties, a boon now that we are all obliged to be more self-reliant with so few ready-made answers in a world of all but defunct authorities, big government, big business, and brand names. New educational facilities created by the new media will shatter the old molds. The new media will supply new means of discriminating between what is real and unreal, true and false. Close triangulated collaboration between teachers, students, and parents, for example, will become easy over the Internet. Ideally, educational online services will encourage teachers to modify curricula for their individual students, not just for particular classes. Parents will be able to sit in on electronic classes and get lesson plans customized for their children. Though online educational facilities will neither make books obsolete nor serve as adequate substitutes for the attention of gifted teachers, they will stimulate new relationships, not just between students and teachers and parents, but with, for instance, experts in domains of specialized knowledge who typically have no time to visit one of today's traditional classrooms or are simply too far away for this to be possible. The new media will give everyone, not just students, the ready means for feedback, questions, demands, and the ability to seek out views different from any that are doled out to us or that we get by means of force feeding. Unfortunately, this does not mean truth will be any easier to arrive at. We will just have more tools with which to explore and debate the issues. We can hope that the consequences of all this will be increased human communication, interaction, and understanding. How do we avoid the numbing of our emotions in the media assault? Immersed in media, it is all too easy to become emotionally alienated. People like myself sat in comfortable living rooms watching snipers in real time on the streets of Sarajevo. Confronted with the horror of what we were witnessing, we hit the psychological equivalent of a remote control button to switch off emotionally, telling ourselves, at some unconscious level, that it was only virtual reality. Yet, in other ways, the new media can foster empathy and cultural integration, sometimes across vast geographical differences. One student in Germany and another in the United States, 8,000 miles apart, can converse online in real time, in school or at home. As they sharpen their language skills, they can strike up a friendship and benefit incalculably from exposure to another culture, to other ways of thinking and doing. On a wider scale, there seems ample room for optimism about the prospect of a crumbling of phobic walls of prejudice based on color, religion, sex, and class. In general, insofar as multimedia bind people together in constant dialogue, we can envision that the new media will allow immeasurably more emotional and intellectual engagement than traditional media have. The old media have long made promises they cannot keep, presenting as they do hopes and visions without listening to the feedback of the hopeless. Like the other technologies of the 20th century, they have been largely useless in addressing the fundamental problems of poverty, war, and prejudice. At the very least, the new media allow everyone to tell his or her story. I am not so foolish as to believe that new technology can solve all of society's problems, but it seems to me that we have nothing to lose by making a grab for all the new potential that dialogue and networks offer in the 21st century. Goodbye, consumer marketing. Welcome to the crossroads of the electronic market. Of course, technology itself is ideologically neutral. Electrons bear no allegiance to anyone or anything, nor does the Internet, the quintessential access medium. From the perspective of business, by the end of the 1990s, when there could, by some estimates, be 200 million Internet users in America, this medium will most closely resemble an ancient marketplace on the Silk Route. These bazaars did not serve merely for the exchange of goods. They were a cultural crossroads where people swapped stories, news, and traditions. Merchants, philosophers, spies, mountebanks, pamphleteers, and prophets plied their trades. All of that cheerful chaos will be reproduced online. Companies will schmooze with customers, prospective customers, and other companies, customers with other customers. Electronic personal agent software, specialized in scouting the web to retrieve information serving the particular needs and interests of particular users, will dive into catalogs, corporate databases, stock market reports, publishers' backlists, and product data, executing transactions while their users sleep. Already, many senior managers enthusiastically tell me how they spend an hour or two on the Internet every evening, keeping up on the activities of competitors and suppliers, reading university research papers, and browsing in news sites on the web. It thus seems inevitable that, in time, the net will become the de facto corporate training resource, superior both in currency and cost-effectiveness to the various forms of management training and education now available, and on which an estimated $40 billion is spent annually. Executives will no longer have to give up time they can ill afford to lose attending three-day off-site lecture programs to keep up with change. Until very recently, the mass broadcast media established dominant brands of products. They are the underpinning for consumer marketing as we know it today. In the bustle of the dynamic participatory marketplace that lies ahead of us, the nature of branding will be subject to profound change as companies adopt other ways of attracting and retaining consumers' attention and patronage. The real-time message. The new digital media fundamentally changed the old broadcast model for communication between institutions and society to one of access. In business, succeeding with these media calls for both imagination and vision, the former to discover and explore uncharted space, the latter to lead in new real-time ways of engaging consumers. Engagement is dialogue. The new digital media will deliver information wrapped in forms of interactive entertainment. Chapter 4. A Brand New Brand. Digital tools have finally given marketing the means to live up to its top dog billing. Management gurus of all stripes have for more than two decades been pronouncing that marketing, the customer's advocate in corporations, no longer merely defines the way an organization attracts buyers, but determines the way a company does business. Yet by comparison with production, engineering, product design, and accounting, this managerial function has until now been instinctive, vague, and suppositional in its methods, as if performed by some mysterious creative means, if not with smoke and mirrors. Marketing, the customer's advocate, has been able to supply little concrete evidence that it knows those customers very well, and that it could therefore direct the rest of the organization to give customers what they want. If marketing has addressed customers en masse through broadcast media, that is because it could no more see them as individuals than a speaker high on a platform addressing a vast audience of blurry faces. The best it could do in trying to present management with a sharper image was to commission market research, studies that often take a month or two for approval, 3 months of preparation, 2 months of field work, and another 2 months of analysis. Forget real time. After that, marketing gatekeepers, as Dave Power of J.D. Power & Associates once described them to me, would debate whether or not to release the data. In consequence, most market research studies were no more than hit-or-miss exercises in justifying decisions already made by the seat of the pants on how to tackle a market. Fortunately, that modus operandi is now seriously out of date. Technology, and in particular the online technology of the Internet in all its various forms and offshoots, has made it possible for companies to be in touch with their customers individually and in real time. With systems like this, a company is often aware of what customers are doing as they do it, can virtually know what customers are thinking from moment to moment, and can give them immediate attention tailored to their particular needs. The gatekeepers of stale, marginally useful market research material are being put out of work by live marketing databases to which everyone in a company can get access, the chairman of the board and the marketing VP, as well as a far-flung junior regional manager, at virtually the same instant a salesperson with a laptop out in the field logs on to enter data gathered from a customer seated beside her. Brand, redefined for the information age. For both marketing theory and practice, the most dramatic implication of this shift to real-time marketing is the complete transformation of the concept of brand. Once, brand was simply about product differentiation. Successful brand names commanded unquestioned loyalty, and they were created chiefly by advertisements broadcast by mass media. These one-way messages were absorbed, often subliminally, by consumers who took them to be virtual instructions on what to buy and where to buy it. Brands had the effect of reducing or eliminating the need to find out about a product before buying it, as one marketing primer put it. But all that is now history. Branding of a new and entirely different kind is being born. Brand as an encapsulation of actual experienced value. The nature of that experience is increasingly determined through customer preferences expressed in dialogue with producers or service providers, an exchange made possible by technology, and one in which the consumer has the upper hand. The turnabout has a curious parallel on the wider stage of society at large, a parallel that, in an illustration of art reflecting life, showed up in a trend in literary fiction. In 1970s and early 1980s America, the reigning school of contemporary literature was known as minimalism. At first, this writing was much admired for being something like the literary equivalent of photorealism in painting, startlingly true to life in its smallest details. Characters did not simply order sodas, but Pepsis or Cokes, did not loll in recliners, but in Lazy Boys, did not roar away in pickups, but in Ford or Chevy trucks. By the mid to late 1980s, when the genre began to fall out of favor with literary critics, it came to be known as Kmart fiction, stories in which people did not walk into any old store but a Kmart, Sears, etc. One principal objection to the genre was that it described a cultural landscape whose most prominent features appeared to be commercial brand names, a shallow society shaped by corporate America's image manipulators. It was fiction weak in drama and characterization and almost bereft of plot, the critics complained, depicting Americans as lacking faith in everything but the material dimension of life, or things defined by brand names. Meanwhile, technology had begun to supply the means for a sort of reverse sculpture, in which society would define the goals and agendas of corporate America. Thanks to technological progress, media tools used to manipulate people's minds could be employed to bend corporate America to society's will. People aren't going to take it anymore. Society, at present, shows every sign of being sicker than ever before of old-fashioned image-mongering brand marketing. In England, for instance, two researchers at the Manchester Business School recently drew attention to the staggering difference between the cost structures of the most and least expensive makers of sunflower margarine. The total manufacturing costs plus profit of the upscale branded product was more than 6 times higher than that of the unbranded, private label, lowest-priced brand. As quoted in the Financial Times, one of the researchers wondered if brand imagery could continue to sustain the differences in the prices shoppers pay for similar or even inferior products. As shoppers become more sophisticated, more willing to trust the retailer to provide products of adequate quality irrespective of the name they carry, many manufacturers of grocery products are likely to have to reduce their internal costs. Commenting on the Manchester study in the Financial Times article, a senior executive at the UK Unilever subsidiary that sells Britain's best-selling brand of margarine correctly pointed out that this particular criticism of brand is an old one. What is different now is that the most progressive companies serving consumers are finally taking steps to reduce their dependence on brand marketing drastically. Instead, they are winning over consumers by ascertaining and responding to their real needs, not the least of these being their wish for fewer brands. Leading this switch is the company with the most hallowed name in conventional brand marketing, Procter & Gamble, which has long specialized in pushing several brand identities, a variety of selling pitches tailored to the susceptibilities of different market segments for virtually the same product. As a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal reported early in 1997, P&G recognized that its 440 promotions a year for 110 brands, which often involved making 55 price changes a day, were only confusing customers. Customers did not, for instance, want the 35 kinds of Bounce fabric softener sold in North America alone. This excess of variety amounted to foisting on consumers choices that P&G thought they should want, what I call broadcast marketing, rather than choices for which consumers had expressed an actual need. In this case, what consumers did need was fewer promotions and less choice. As noted in the article, today's average consumer has less time to browse. It is down 25% from 5 years ago. This consumer typically spends 21 minutes buying an average of 18 items out of 30,000 to 40,000 choices. This is not, as it might appear to be, a contradiction of my observation in Chapter 2 that consumers expect to be given even more choice in the future than they have now. Consumers always want more choice, but consumers burdened by choice, as they often are today, begin to look for meaningful choice, or choice that better reflects what they really do want or need at any particular moment. Hence, the same Wall Street Journal article notes that although one P&G customer, Giant Food, an East Coast chain of 174 supermarkets, is cutting down on baby-related products and detergents in response to its shoppers' preferences, customer preferences also led the chain to expand the variety of Pringles chips it carried from 2 to 5. P&G has redirected its effort from marketing brand names to building close relationships with retailers that enable them to benefit from grocery stores' knowledge of and insights into customer behavior. Most significantly, after 159 years, P&G is changing the name of its sales department to Customer Business Development, a change that may seem largely symbolic, but that within a tradition-bound company such as Procter & Gamble is a watershed event. The company decided it is wiser to let consumers drive supply than to force-feed retailers by making them buy more products than they can sell. We still love our factories more than we love our customers. The practice of burying retailers and customers under mountains of products and promotions that P&G has begun to reverse has, of course, been standard in consumer marketing. Technology, applied to production and market segmentation, is responsible for this interment. But technology, applied to communication, will also take the credit for disinterring consumers. The old-style brand was a brilliant device for encouraging mass consumption of mass-produced things, a cornucopia of low-cost, commodity-like goods among which brands served to create largely illusory differences. That approach had its heyday between 1980 and 1990, when production capacity in both the United States and Japan grew more than 100%. This turned almost all industries into factory-driven businesses, churning out products at the fastest rate in history. Industry cheered the rise of new distribution channels, direct marketing, catalog sales, giant malls, and superstores because these quickly multiplying outlets for goods kept factories, with their hugely expanded capacity, fully occupied. But competition also intensified, and that put extraordinary pressure on marketing. Companies looked to marketing to keep the factories at full capacity by inventing new markets, creating demand, and moving their products. Much of the burden actually fell on advertising, on which almost $180 billion is still spent each year in the United States. Advertising agencies, as the architects of brand image, came to be seen as the ultimate generators of demand, and in the increasingly turbulent competitive environment, were hired and fired more frequently. Some surprisingly large companies have yet to get the message that this production-driven model for selling is counterproductive. After years of meager profit margins, the world's largest company, General Motors, rolled out in 1996 an anachronistic marketing strategy intended to boost earnings. To this end, GM had hired specialists from Procter & Gamble with experience marketing detergent and mouthwash. Predictably, the new strategy turned on brand-based product differentiation, founded on advertising. This approach was intended to publicize not only the differences between GM vehicles and those of rivals, but the differences between the autos and trucks of GM's own Buick, Oldsmobile, and Chevrolet divisions. Arguably, if the company had over the years established intense two-way communication with customers, the differences between its models would be both attractive and obvious to prospective buyers, because those differences would reflect what those customers had said they wanted. GM would then hardly have needed to turn to the broadcast marketing method of advertising, which was of dubious value in any case because of automobile industry experts' concern about GM's sluggish rate of new product introduction and its relatively leisurely pace of production. Company management justified this slowness as necessary to improving the quality of its products. But the trade-off betrays GM's production-driven mentality, whose golden age was the 1950s and 1960s. A market-driven company, properly oriented for the millennium, would know it could not afford the luxury of focusing on quality at the expense of timeliness. This is simply not an option in the age of real time, in which now is probably the most critical aspect of good in consumers' minds. Though the penalties of GM's factory-focused management model have been noted for some time and on many fronts, Manufacturing Systems reported in 1992 that GM had spent $40 billion on factory automation in the 1980s and yet still lagged in productivity. In 1996, a study by the consulting firm of Harbor & Associates in Troy, Michigan, suggested the dimensions of the competitive disadvantage GM had created for itself through its insistence on making 70% of its own car components, compared with Ford's 50% and Chrysler's 30%. GM's labor costs for car components were $440 higher per vehicle than Ford's and $600 higher than Chrysler's. In addition, because of the company's obsession with manufacturing, marketing at GM, as at many auto companies, failed to move with the times. Dave Power told me that whereas computer-aided design and manufacturing have significantly cut costs in the industry, costs allocated to transportation, marketing, advertising, and incentives have remained high. They account for 30% of total costs and are still rising. Power added, "That is about $6,000 per car. That number has grown, yet the marketing people are frightened of changing the status quo. I was at a meeting in Europe recently where the head of one of the large auto manufacturers said, it used to be that marketing chided manufacturing for being too conservative and backward. Now it is marketing that is unwilling to change and is seen as being in the dark ages." Yet, even high technology companies that consider the automakers to be dinosaurs are themselves guilty of factory-driven rather than modern marketing. And they are justly criticized for rank insensitivity to consumers' needs. As the historian and social commentator Theodore Roszak complains, their products are maddeningly hard to use. Many people are desperately trying to master the information superhighway these days because they hope there is a magic machine that will soothe their high-tech fury by telling them all they need to know about this big, confusing world. But what they find along the superhighway is more technological dependency, computer protocols, networking complexities, and constantly shifting interfaces that are even harder to master than their VCR controls. Computers confront us with ever-increasing levels of complexity. One brings the machine home only to discover within a few months' time that nothing works as advertised. The parts are incompatible. The error messages that flash across the screen are as inscrutable as pronouncements by the Oracle of Delphi. Computers are authentically hard to use. They are not well designed. The programs get bigger and glitchier and more time-consuming to learn with every upgrade. Roszak's complaints are, of course, widespread, and consumers grow all the more baffled and enraged when high-tech companies make claims of user-friendly or easy-to-install products. Business carves up ever smaller pieces of the pie. The first phase of the information age has actually exacerbated the factory-driven approach to marketing, even if it has brought sweeping changes to the way factories spew out their products and marketers go about finding homes for them. Computers, assisting with everything from design to distribution, have made it easier and cheaper to develop new products, and at wildly accelerated speeds. 3 months, for instance, for products that used to take 3 years from conception to manufacture. Computers have also made it possible to turn out goods in smaller, high-quality lots, and to distribute them more efficiently. And they have allowed producers to cater profitably to ever narrower market segments. Databases slice markets into every imaginable grouping. Flexible design and production methods are used to supply what companies think, often inaccurately, that this segment or that one wants. Procter & Gamble, for example, only recently discovered that mothers did not want his and hers diapers, which it promptly replaced with unisex Pampers. Because all companies have access to the same computer-based tools, competition has forced even laggards to adopt product and market segmentation. To compete with the latest segment-specific brands on the block, long-established companies have launched hosts of brand extensions, Old El Paso Salsa from Pillsbury to fight El Paso Chili, a high-end gourmet salsa, and Red Dog Ale from Miller Brewing Company to battle the products of the microbreweries. The curious result of the proliferation of computer-based tools capable of creating unprecedented diversity is that look-alike products, from potato chips to computer chips, crowd ever smaller market segments. The fragmentation of markets has been given extra impetus by the growing ranks of small